Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and we are a podcast that's dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. And in thinking seriously, if you're brand new, what that means is we've tried to encourage and cultivate an intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, cheerful confessionalism. So those are four C's that just kind of, I mean, I'm a Baptist, so I have to have like alliteration. I think that's what it's called, alliteration. So you got C's. The main idea is just we want to be kind and virtuous people and interact with all sorts of ideas in the most robust way. And so part of that means that we should be interested in people who disagree with us and people who have very different views, because we can learn things from that, even if we realize that actually I disagree even deeper than I thought. It can still be a great formative intellectual experience to engage other ideas. On the flip side, we just want to explore lots of good topics and things and promote different things. But like I said, I mean, we talk to all sorts of people about all sorts of topics, history, philosophy, theology, anything related to it. It's a ton of fun. So today we have Dr. Simon Kennedy. We're going to be talking about his new book, Against Worldview, Reimagining Christian Formation as Growth in Wisdom. And this is Lexham, right,
Simon? Yeah, published through Lexham. That's right.
Yeah, so Lexham, I feel like they're pumping out a ton of volumes over the last couple of years, especially with desirable-looking covers and some interesting content. So I'm excited to talk about this, Simon. Tell me a little bit about yourself, and maybe then give me sort of like the origin story of this book.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Jordan, for having me on. Really glad to be here and glad to be speaking to your listeners. Just want to say at the outset, I love the philosophy behind the podcast. Love what you guys are doing. Totally with you on the four C's. I'm a confessional Presbyterian. Live in Queensland in Australia. You can probably tell by my accent that I'm not from where you're from. And I'm part of the Presbyterian Church of Australia. Teach at various institutions. So I've got a doctorate in history. So I'm a historian mainly, and that's my kind of main trade, I guess you would say. But I've worked in a range of areas, public policy, the arts. I've lectured in liberal arts colleges and universities and seminaries. I teach at the moment a little bit at Queensland Theological Seminary and at the Lachlan Macquarie Institute and Presbyterian Theological College, which is down in Melbourne. I also am a senior research fellow at the University of Queensland and a non-resident fellow at the Danube Institute, which is in Budapest. So I have a Hungarian connection in there as well. And yeah, that's basically what I'm doing at the moment. As far as where this book comes from, it's an interesting one for me because I'm a historian. And so most of my work is in the history of ideas, intellectual history, history of philosophy. And a lot of my previous work's been around Christianity or the intersections between legal and political ideas and Christianity. And so that's been my main interest. However, while I was teaching on those topics in a Christian context, I became, troubled or frustrated. I don't want to overstate it, but I guess I found it a little bit frustrating how we were framing in the institutions I was in, how we were framing this idea that we were teaching from a Christian worldview perspective. And I'd done a lot of work on the Neo-Calvinist tradition and Abraham Kuyper in my earlier scholarly life. And so I knew a lot about where these ideas came from. I felt like I understood them. I felt like I was on board with them in a lot of ways and still am. But once it came down to practically, applying the idea of teaching from a Christian worldview perspective or even teaching from a Christian perspective in the classroom, I really wanted to work out how does this work? And I also wanted to work out why it didn't feel like it did work very well. So I thought I'll tackle it. I'll write a little book on it, delve into the idea, and then try and work out how to make it work better for us going forward. So that's a bit about me and a bit about the origin story of the book.
So the title's provocative. Were you the one who came up with the idea for the title?
you know I wasn't. The very clever people at Lexham Press chose that one. It goes in the same direction as Peter Lighthart's Against Christianity, Doug Wilson's Against the Church. You know, it's neither of those people, like Peter's not against Christianity. Doug is not against the church. I'm not against worldview. The title implies that I'm against worldview entirely, but it's a provocative title deliberately designed to sell books. But it also does say something. I am against worldview in a certain sense, and we need to reframe it. So yeah, no, you're right. The title's there to sell books, but I think it works because it does point to what I'm doing, which is trying to reframe the whole idea of worldview to make it work better.
So when we think about worldview, I mean, what is the most common understanding of worldview? Like if I go talk to somebody who's using that terminology today, what do they mean by it? And when we move that into the Christian sphere and we talk about Christian worldview, is there also a common understanding there for that?
Yeah. Yeah. So what the classic definition of worldview, I mean, I'm just picking one, but I think Al Walters' book, Creation Regained, is really one of the core fundamental texts of worldview thinking in the Reformed and Evangelical world. And he defines worldview as the comprehensive framework of one's basic beliefs about things. A couple of other definitions. I mean, there are so many definitions, and this is part of why the worldview concept, I think, is a bit problematic. But a couple of other definitions. James Orr, who is one of the earlier thinkers who wrote about Christian worldview, he says it's the widest view which the mind can take on things. So basically, it's this big overarching view on things. It's a view that is an effort to grasp them together as a whole. So it's wide and comprehensive. And he also says that it's from a particular philosophical or theological perspective. So it's particular, and in a sense, it's relative. It's coming from a particular perspective. And so you can see in those definitions there of worldview, just more generally, as Walters says, it's a comprehensive framework of one's basic beliefs. But you know, the second part of your question is, what is a Christian worldview? There's a lot of definitions on this. My definition that I state in the book is that Christian worldview is a true apprehension of reality that is attained through the process of learning about God, the self, and the world. So that's my definition of a Christian worldview. And one thing people might notice about my definition here is that I leave out the idea of an overarching view or an effort to grasp everything together as a whole, or the idea of a comprehensive framework. I sort of take that out, because this is one problematic aspect of the concept of worldview, which I think we need to move away from. And that's because worldview tends to reduce knowledge of God and the self and the world to a framework. And it pretends that this framework is somehow comprehensive. But I don't think either of those things are actually attainable in this life before the return of Christ. So I think we're much more limited than that. And so my thinking about worldview in this way my thinking is that thinking about worldview in this way it gives a false sense of coherence and depth. The reality is that our worldviews are always mixed up, always inconsistent, always tainted with error, always imperfect. And so Christian worldview is not a comprehensive Christian understanding of reality that we can just get at by thinking consistently or with the correct presuppositions or thinking with the right frameworks. I think we can aim for a Christian worldview, but I don't think we can get it consistently or perfectly. So that's why I say it's a true apprehension of reality that's attained through the process of learning about God, the self, and the world.
Yeah, so it seems like you have a couple of different critiques of Christian worldview, and one of those, like you've mentioned here, that you were saying there's no such thing as the Christian worldview. There's a bunch of like many a Christian worldviews. I mean, in what sense then are we talking about this? So if I'm talking, like I hear Al Mohler on the briefing all the time, Christian worldview, that might be in the tagline or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah.
If he's talking about that and he's just saying, like, all I'm assuming when I talk about Christian worldview is just this basic understanding that God is creator, that he's came and he's redeemed us from sin, and these just very broad, generic categories, and saying, I'm using this super broad category, is that not something that we should say is the Christian worldview? It seems like we'd want to say God is creator and God is redeemer, and if we just take it these really thin sense, then there is a sense in which, yeah, there is the Christian worldview. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah, it does. Yeah. And I'm not a relativist, and so I totally agree with you. You know, there are basic fundamental truths that we can say frame our view of reality and the way that we might think about things. Okay, so that's fine. I wouldn't want to disagree with that. So we could say that is the Christian worldview, sure. So maybe we can say, okay, basic creedal Christianity, the kind of assertions or statements in the Christian creeds can be grounding for a basic Christian worldview. Look, that's fine, but how far does that get us when we start thinking about what I think someone like Al Mohl is trying to do, which is to think about current affairs from a Christian worldview perspective, or even more complicated, starting to frame education from a Christian worldview perspective. So, and part of the reason why I don't think there is the Christian worldview as such, apart from in a very thin sense that you've said there, is that, you know, only three people have a perfect Christian worldview: God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit, right? Apart from that, there's no pristine, attainable Christian worldview that's available to us as humans. We can't get a perfect Christian worldview because we're limited in so many ways. Now, as Christians, I think we can be sanctified, and I think our thinking can be sanctified, and our minds can be expanded, and we can grow in knowledge. I think that's how God's made us. God's made us to do those things, to renew our minds, to improve our learning, and to grow in His world and in wisdom and knowledge in His world. And as we do this, I think we will gain a Christian worldview, but it will be a Christian worldview, not the Christian worldview, because I don't think the latter is possible in the sense that people often want it to be possible. So you go.
No, I'll just say that makes sense.
Right, yeah, and that's good. And I'm not I want to reaffirm, I'm not a relativist. I just think that, you know, there's one God, there's one world, there's one reality, and I think we're all trying to access that reality and understand that reality. So there's one truth that we're all trying to get at, but we're going to come at that imperfectly. And so I don't think we can expect to get the Christian worldview in the way that people might say.
So one thing you say, and I think this may be early on in the book, you said something along the lines of God and His word can be dishonored by well-meant attempts to work within a Christian worldview approach. Mm. So where is it that people are going wrong when they're doing this? Is it problematic that they're trying to universalize something that is not possible? And so they're like putting these sort of like straitjackets and parameters on people that shouldn't be there. So it's like almost eliminating Christian liberty, or it's a false sense of superiority or you're lacking humility. Like what's actually the problem?
Yeah. Good question. There are a number of ways this can work itself out as a problem. So, you know, you've listed a few, which I think are all possible ways that, you know, someone coming with a very robust, what they would describe as, you know, like a really robust understanding of Christian worldview, I'm going to come at everything I'm doing from a Christian worldview perspective, and it's going to be great, and, you know, I'm going to honor God doing this. Now, I think here's a really important point I want to make, and it kind of qualifies everything I'm saying, I guess, in this interview and in the book, is that I'm on the same, like, we're all on the same team. So everyone who wants to do Christian worldview thinking and Christian worldview stuff, I'm with them. You know, we're all trying to get at the same thing, which is honoring God in every sphere of life. You know, I'm a Presbyterian Christian, I'm Reformed, I'm Evangelical. I want to do those things as well. So the question is, how do we do that? I think worldview doesn't help so much, and here's why. And as you point out, I think it actually has the sometimes the application of these ideas, these worldview ideas, can actually dishonor God and His word. Let me give you an example of how this can happen, especially in an education context. So I've seen lots of examples where earnest Christian educators are trying to ensure that they're faithful in the classroom or in the lecture hall or wherever they are. And their approach to this is to use the Bible as much as possible. Okay, so they go, okay, how can we make sure that we're being Christian in the classroom or in the lecture hall? Let's just use the Bible as much as possible. So, for example, I saw in one of my, so our kids are homeschool, and they were doing some English phonics stuff in a workbook, and one of the things they were working on was the word parts. The section in the book they were looking at was discussing the idea of parts or pieces or sections, and trying to get these concepts into their heads. And so they had to fill in these sentences which had blanks in them. And one of the sentences said, "God is made up of three blank." And the word that the kids were supposed to put in there was the word parts. But that's heresy. I mean, that's such a mess to do that. And so these, you know, well-intentioned, like these are Orthodox Christians, they're normal Christians, were trying to fit in Christian theology into their English phonics textbook. And they end up saying something heretical and false. God is not made up of parts, you know. And so this is one example of how this can go very wrong. It's only one example, but let me give you another one. I often see Christian Science textbooks which jam in Bible verses. For example, there might be a section on zoology or discussing birds, and so they quote a verse in the Psalms about birds as though that offers some kind of insight about the biology of birds. But actually, the Psalms don't say anything about that. The Psalms are often making a completely different point to the one that the scientist wants to make. And it's not to say that you can't, you know, quote the scriptures to illustrate something. However, that seems to me to be a misuse of God's word. And this can happen. I'm only giving two examples just because we don't have time to go into all the details. But I want to sort of show this as a... These are real concrete examples of how I think people who are well-meaning and earnest Christian educators can, in the end, like butcher what God is saying in his word. And they're trying to do it for the right reasons, but the application's a mess. That's just one way this can go wrong.
So then is the reality here to say, like, look, guys, when you're in these other subject fields, whether it's English or physics or car mechanics or whatever it is, like being a Christian doesn't have to mean like pigeonholing, like this wrench is a display of God's X, Y, Z. It's like, chill out and do your thing. Like, and that's fine. Is that sort of part of the application here?
Yeah, I think that's a really nice summary of what I'm partly going for. And it sounds like a pretty banal kind of application, but actually, in the end, I mean, a lot of areas of knowledge and practical skill in the world are equally accessible to Christians and non-Christians, okay? So that's my view. There will be a lot of maybe your listeners out there who don't agree with that, but I'm not a presuppositionalist, and I reject some of those tenets that suggest that Christians have some kind of epistemic advantage over non-Christians. Now, I think there is a sliding scale here. So I want to say clearly that in some areas of thought and life, Christians have an obvious advantage over non-Christians. Okay. And so when we're thinking about what a human person is, we're thinking about human psychology, and there are other things, even things maybe in the middle of the scale, things like law and politics. You know, Christians have a certain kind of head start, I guess, toward grasping certain truths about those areas and disciplines that maybe non-Christians wouldn't have. Having said that, particularly as well in areas like law and politics, a lot of this stuff is just, you know, built into the way God's made the world. It's not special revelation in the scriptures. So I don't think that there's an epistemic advantage there. And so, yeah, definitely part of my thinking is, guys, just chill out and teach and learn the things you need to teach and learn in the best way possible. And often if you try and stick Christian stuff in the way of that learning, that's what it does. It gets in the way, and it might even hinder your learning and your teaching in a way that's unhelpful, because God's world it's out there. We can get at it. It's sitting there ready for us to learn about, and we can go and live in it, and we can go and practice skills in it. We can go and be wise in it. We don't have to do that necessarily from a Christian worldview perspective to get that right.
Yeah. And I think you mentioned in the book, you know, especially in the education context, that like, the line in the syllabus that requires you to be like, this is contributing to a Christian worldview and X, Y, Z. Like, I remember seeing that and thinking, you know, it does seem rather like, this is a statistics class. Like, okay, let me try to like find some like obscure way to make this about theology. And it seems like, no, like it can just be about numbers.
Yeah, that's it.
That's okay.
I think that's exactly right. And I think as Christians, we need to accept that that's the case for a lot of things that we do in schools and colleges. And I love God. I love Jesus. I want to point to God and make everything about him as much as possible. But sometimes statistics are just statistics and biology is just biology. It doesn't mean you can't, you can definitely have your Christian worldview informing what you're doing in that very thin, high-level sense that you're talking about. But I just find it really problematic that we have to make everything more Christian by, bureaucracy or Bible verses or whatever. So part of what I'm doing in the book is, trying to reframe some of that, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, and making things like overly Christian-y almost makes me just feel like these, at least in the context that I've been, these like awkward evangelical vibes where it's like, we just got to like make everything like hyper Christian because they like just don't understand how to be normal people in the world.
Yeah.
Makes me think just more generally about the history of this, the ideas of Christian worldview. I know you talk about Kuyper and Colson and some others. I mean, maybe give me a little bit of the 30,000 foot lay of the land on like how this comes about.
Yep. Yeah. And if people want to read more on this, there's a whole chapter on it in the book, but there's also an article, which is open access in Church History Journal, which people can find on the Church History Journal website if they want to delve into this a bit more. But let me give you the 30,000 foot version. So worldview, the idea of worldview or Weltanschauung comes originally from Kant and Schelling and Hegel. So these German idealist philosophers. Now, I want to say I don't actually have a problem with that. Like, that's not a problem for me. That's not why the idea is a problem. So sometimes I think people get very carried away with, oh, it's a German idealist thing and we need to reject it. That's not where I'm coming from. So that I'm just saying that's where it originated as a concept. It was adopted in the late 19th century, originally by a Scottish Presbyterian called James Orr. People often think of Abraham Kuyper as the first worldview thinker. It actually came from James Orr, and he had a big book on this topic before Kuyper did his stone lectures, where he sort of originally started unpacking this idea a bit more. So you had James Orr, Abraham Kuyper, and you really had the beginning of this worldview thinking, a Christian worldview thinking, in that context there in the late 19th century, so the 1890s. My reading of this is that these two thinkers here and the people in their orbit, and you have Herman Bavinck writing about this not too long after Kuyper does as well, so you can see the idea is starting to take hold in certain reformed circles in Europe. My thinking on this is that these men are responding to something concrete that's happening in the world at that time. And in Europe, you have a fairly rapid secularization occurring. And you have thinkers like Friedrich Nietzsche and the emergence of distinct, philosophical and cultural movements that are unbelieving and in some cases anti-Christian. And so Christian thinkers are naturally trying to find a way to articulate their vision of life and their understanding of reality over and against these new and fairly, prominent systems of thought and frameworks. And so what you have here is, I think, a bit of a reaction. So Christian worldview, I think, originally is a reaction to unbelieving philosophy and secularization and an increasing sense of hostility toward the faith that seems to be growing in the late 19th century. Now, Christianity still has significant cultural cachet at this time, so it's not like the situation today in a lot of the West where the church is really marginalized and so on. So I'm not suggesting that's the context necessarily, but I think that's starting to build at that point. And I think this is where Orr and Kuyper are situated. As you go through the 20th century, it's interesting, the Presbyterians, in Europe, particularly in Scotland, don't really take on Orr's ideas very much at all. The people who really take on this worldview idea are the Dutch, and they bring that over to North America and to Australia in the sort of Free Church Dutch movement, the CRC movements, and there are various offshoots. And by the middle of the 20th century, you have people like Rush Dooney and Barnson, and then eventually Francis Schaeffer, who are all influenced by this neo-Calvinist strand in Reformed thought. Once you get to Schaeffer, who is he's a popularizer, but also a sort of public intellectual, in the proper sense of the word. And he is articulating Christian positions about public issues and cultural issues. But he frames it as a combat of world, a kind of combat between worldviews. And so that's one of the things I think that's really important to notice about the history of this discourse, is that this is what I call a combat concept. Worldview is used and deployed in cultural combat. And this is definitely how Schaeffer uses it. It's how Rush Dooney uses it. It's how Kuyper and James Orr use it. It's how all these early worldview thinkers, I guess you would call them, use worldview as a concept. And they are driving at pushing back against what they think are false worldviews. And they're trying to distinguish between the Christian position on, say, abortion and the non-Christian position on abortion, or the Christian position on war and the non-Christian position on war. They're trying to distinguish between Christian culture and non-Christian culture, and so on. And they use worldview to do that. And they really do frame it as a war. And eventually you have someone like Nancy Piercy, who's someone I really admire. And so when I criticize her, I'm not, you know, of course, shouldn't have to say this, but I'm not against everything all these people do. But Piercy at one point and Coulson frame the tension between belief and unbelief as a cosmic war of worldviews. And so at this point, it's clear it's a combat concept. But it's interesting how this worldview concept is then translated somehow into the classroom and into education settings. And it's a very, very different context to having public discourse about ideas. So my thinking is we need to move away from worldview as a concept more generally, but definitely in education contexts where we're trying to think about Christian education, because the original purpose of the word was not to frame education. It was cultural combat and public discourse. So that's my sort of high level intellectual history of the idea.
Okay, that's really, really interesting and helpful. So when you think of the terminology in this combat concept, where it's just really broad, like Christianity versus atheism, in that context, for these older thinkers, is that an appropriate way to sort of wield the terminology, or are there still some gaps there?
I think the fundamental philosophical problems with worldview remain. So if you look at Orr and Kuyper, they're saying that there is a Christian worldview, or even in Kuyper's case, he talks about a Calvinist worldview, you know, so quite a specific thing, and a Lutheran worldview and a Roman Catholic worldview. And they talk as though these worldviews are monolithic and neat and consistent, and that they work themselves out in the world in certain ways that are observable. Now, I think actually if pressed, these guys would probably say, oh yeah, I didn't mean it like that. You know, if I said to them, but that's just too neat and too monolithic, they would be like, yeah, no, you're right. But they don't qualify it very much. They don't say, oh, it's actually all a lot messier than what we're saying. They say there is this worldview and it is going to do these things in the world, which I think is misleading and not true. Okay, so I think at the bottom there is still a fundamental problem with the concept of worldview. Having said that, you know, and this is where this can become, it feels like it can become semantic, right? This is sort of a semantic, you know, disagreement. Having said that, there is a difference between a Christian way of thinking and a non-Christian way of thinking, and there are differences between Reformed Protestant thinking and Calvinist thinking. Oh, no, sorry, not Calvinist, Lutheran thinking or Roman Catholic thinking. Like, there are distinctions, and we can think about those things and work those things out and work out how, you know, our ideas as Reformed Protestants, for example, can work their way out in different aspects of life. I think that's a good thing to do. So I'm not against that project as such, but I think that worldview language is misleading if that's how we're using it.
Yeah, no, okay, that makes sense. So One thing you do in the book is you critique a little bit like the sort of deductive teaching elements where you're assuming some sort of Christian first principle. And I'd love to talk a little bit more about why that is the case and why you think we should approach things more from a deductive, or I mean, from an inductive approach.
The distinction. So I get the distinction between inductive and deductive worldview thinking, or thinking in general. Originally, it's obviously a basic philosophical distinction. So I'm not saying this is the first time I've come across it. But I guess when I was thinking about worldview education, the way that I've saw this distinction helpfully articulated was when James Eglinton, in his biography of Herman Bavinck, was talking about the differences between Kuyper and Bavinck. And he suggested that Kuyper did his thinking from a high vantage point, and he judged, you know, he looked down and judged the world from this high vantage point. So that he had a deductive approach to his analysis of things. Whereas Bavinck did his thinking from a starting point, like Eglinton calls it a starting point. That is, he started from the world, from the ground up, and he wrote and thought things through bit by bit, and he built rather than kind of proclaimed from on high, if you will. And so this is where Bavinck's critical realism comes into my argument. And critical realism is basically the idea that there is, unity between subject and object, or if you want to use more normal language, there's unity between the knower, or the persons that are doing the thinking, and the knowing, and the thing being known. So we can look at something and begin to grasp it as it really is, and even grow in our knowledge of that thing. And we can start doing that with ordinary experience in the world. So that's an affirmation of the critical realist can make. And so we can actually get at truth and about reality from our lived experience, not perfectly or completely. That's not what I'm claiming. But the basic ground of knowledge about reality is actually reality itself. Like we can experience reality and then know about it and really get at it. Now, why is this possible? Well, Bavinck argues that this is possible because there's a common origin for both subject and object, or for the knower and the thing being known. The common origin is God. God created both, you and the thing that you're thinking about. And so Bavinck then says, well, why would God create a person or a knower and an object or a world or a thing in the world, and then make the correspondence between those two things fundamentally disjointed? Why would he do that? As Christians, we don't have a good reason to affirm that he would make it disjointed. In fact, quite the opposite. The Bible affirms correspondence between our minds and our apprehension of the things that we're thinking about. And there's lots of examples in the book that I give that affirm that. And so that's the basic starting point when I'm thinking about inductive and deductive. And I'm also thinking, okay, so if we can look at reality and sort of and learn about it at a basic level and sort of trust our experience, then the next question is, okay, how do we learn about the reality that God's made that we can know about? How do we learn about that? And because otherwise this is just empiricism, right? Like we're just saying, okay, well, we can just learn from experience. That's empiricism. We can actually also, though, gather our knowledge into groups or into universal truths. So we can actually know big ideas and first principles as well. So, and those principles can precede our apprehension of reality and our experience. So it's both. It's both experience and universal principles that we can apprehend prior to that. Now, why does this matter? Well, it matters because it impacts how we think about how we learn. So I think the way I understand how humans learn is we learn bit by bit. We learn to crawl, and then we learn to walk, and then we run, right, as an image of how this works. I don't think we fundamentally start with big, high-level deductive principles and then analyze everything from there. Now, I am pro-catechism. I'm pro-systematic theology. You know, we need some of these deductive universal truths we need these universal truths to frame what we're doing to an extent. So I'm not rejecting that as a possibility or even as something that's important. I think it is important. But actually, I think when we're thinking about the task of learning and the task of teaching, we need to think about it as an inductive process, not a deductive process. Often what worldview thinking tends toward is starting with big, high-level worldview, Christian worldview concepts, and then fitting everything that we're learning about into those concepts or trying to make them, you know, trying to force those concepts into the thing that we're learning about. But I think that distorts, that can have two problems. It can distort the Christian worldview concepts, and it can distort the things that we're teaching or learning about in an unhelpful way. I think we need to think about learning as an inductive process, because I think that's what it is in reality. So that's why I make this distinction between deductive and inductive, because I think if we're thinking about Christian education, we need to emphasize the inductive nature of learning, not at the total expense of deductive thought, because that's still necessary, but it's about what is education and how do we learn fundamentally.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. And that sort of naturally leads to, you talk about critical realist epistemology at some point in the book. And I guess as I'm thinking about the deductive inductive approach in my head, and you can tell me where you fit on this, I've kind of thought of it sort of as like a circle where you can start with inductive, and that sort of adds pieces to the deductive approach, which then goes back to the inductive, and you're revising. And it's kind of like just going back and forth in a circle where you're constantly updating and tweaking and adjusting. So it's not like the top-down pressure is so exerted a force to where you can't actually change any of the pieces. It's a both and going up and down approach. Is that similar to what you're thinking?
That feels right to me. That's why I want to hold on to both. So in the, you know, in the book, I emphasize inductive a lot. But I totally agree with you. I think it is. These two things interact over and over, and it's actually just not clear how they interact. Like, we could try and theorize it, right? I mean, I like your circle image. That's great. I wish I'd used that. That's helpful. I couldn't think of a way of explaining it, so I just didn't bother. No. But I think it's.
And I know
right,
in real life,
basically,
it doesn't exactly happen like that. You know, it's not like this perfect where you're constantly going, like, it's completely messy and all over
that's
the place.
Right.
And it seems like that's what you're trying to say, is like, there's not this perfect one size fits all approach to education where you can just like shove everything in here and you're always going to get the right answer.
That's it. That's it. Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think we need to accept that, you know, if we're thinking about Christian education, we're thinking about schools, we're thinking about lecturing or whatever we're doing. Yeah, I think the deductive concepts are there. They're important. They're going to interact with learning in a lot of important ways. But yeah, I think that if we're going to think about education philosophy, like a philosophy of Christian education, thinking about it as an inductive is much more fruitful in my view. And I think it, you know, I'm a critical realist, and so I think that also makes sense of that philosophy, helps us make sense of that. But, you know, I understand that people may have different epistemologies and so on. So there might be some fundamental disagreements here with some people's approaches to this. But I don't, you know, these two things make sense to me, and they fit together really well. And I think they also just make sense of what learning is like in reality. So, yeah, that's where I'm coming from.
So if you had an ideal reader for this book, who are you hoping, like, I really want this type of person to read this?
So there are a few people who I'd like to read it. Probably most importantly, I want people who are involved in and influential in Christian education. So I'd love for teachers in schools and professors in colleges, whether they're in a Christian college or in another institution, and seminary profs to read this book. I think there's plenty of material in here for all of those people to go away and reshape and rethink their approach to education. I'd love for pastors to read it, because I think that this could impact the way that they think about formation and discipleship more generally. And often, you know, we're in Reformed churches, we're thinking about things like student ministry and missions and outreach. And we still think in terms of worldview and, you know, Christian worldview apologetics, and how we frame some of that, and evangelism and so on, and even discipleship. So I think about youth, you know, youth groups in churches and so on, they often might think in worldview terms. I want to help people rethink that. And so I'm hopeful that people in Christian ministry will also find it helpful, you know, and even people like you and me who are Christian parents, right? And they might be wanting to think some of this stuff through as well. So, I mean, I guess you've got your three tiers there. But yeah, definitely educators. And then I'm hoping that it will be helpful for pastors and parents as well.
So do you, in your mind, have a follow-up project to this one that's specifically related to it that you're working on?
Yeah. Funny that you ask, because I originally didn't. I thought, you know, I'm a historian. I've only got so much time, and this might be my main contribution to this conversation. However, I'm going to have the opportunity to work with someone on other aspects of the book coming up. So I'm hoping to delve more into Charlotte Mason and her thought in the next couple of years. And so it will probably be maybe less about worldview thinking and more about a Christian philosophy of education more broadly, but it'll flow out of this project. And I'm really hoping that any further work I do will just, you know, strengthen the case I'm making here. So hopefully there's more to come, Jordan. Yeah.
No, that's super interesting. And I don't know a lot about Charlotte Mason. I know a very little about it. So about her and her work. So I'll be very intrigued.
I will be too. I mean, one of the interesting things about her, Jordan, just before we, you know, like to go off on a tiny tangent, is that her, she's a really serious thinker, you know, and she has big books and volumes on philosophy of education and pedagogy and so on, which I'm still making my way through. Most of the people who interact with Mason are acolytes. So they're people who are massive fans of her. They have an ideological interest in her. And so you have this really interesting situation where you've got I think someone who's actually a really substantial thinker but she's not really read as critically as maybe she should be, and I mean that in the best sense of criticism. Like, I think that there's more to her than what we originally think. So I think it'll be good for someone like myself to go, okay, I'm not an ideologue. I'm going to read her seriously and take her seriously from the perspective of a scholar and see what we can find out. So I'm really interested to do that.
Yeah, no, that's super, because I think the first couple of times I heard her name, it was basically from people who were like, I want to homeschool my kids, but I don't actually want to teach them anything. I want them just to go out and like play in the woods and like leave me alone. It's like, okay, what's going on here?
I'm not, hopefully I'm not, that's not where I'm headed.
So if people do want to follow with your work though, like, do you have a website or is there an easy place to find you?
Yep. I don't have a website. Maybe I should, but you can find me on X at SPKENN1. You can see my Twitter page there. I don't actually tweet very much. I'm a pretty boring person on Twitter, but I do post my work when I do stuff on there. You can go to my academia.edu page and I list all my papers and people can click through and access those if they want to. And you can find me on my institutional pages. So, I mean, there's stuff on my University of Queensland page at the law school there if people want to have a look at that. But probably the easiest place is to go to X and to the academia pages, and you can kind of find out more about me on there.
Awesome. Now, who was it are you familiar with? I can't remember his name. He wrote The Crisis of Civil Law with Lexham.
Ben Saunders. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, is he a similar institution as you somewhere, somehow?
Yeah, no, Ben and I are good friends, actually. Okay. He lives a long way away from me, but we actually were elders in the same church for a time. Ben is down at Deakin University, similar institution, though, so he's in a law school down there. We've actually done a bunch of work together, so people can read out. We've done some co-authoring. Yeah, so Ben's a great guy, really good man and good scholar.
So I just remembered it when you said law and I was like, oh wait, I've talked to somebody who is in Australia. Yeah. If you're listening right now, you can go find, we've done the episode. It may have been a year ago now, but somewhere in there, The Crisis of Civil Law. If you search for it, you'll find it.
Another Lexham book. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. Another Lexham book. Another, I mean, I really think Lexham's covers are very, very well done.
They're really good, aren't they?
Who's doing them, but they're,
I love mine brilliant. Actually. Mine's so good. Yeah. I love it.
So this has been great. Simon, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk about this. I think it's an interesting and important topic. So for those who are listening, I'm going to make sure there's always a link to any book we're talking about. I put the link there. You can click it. You can purchase the book. You can purchase 10 of them. You can purchase 20 of them, whatever it is that, you know, you want to buy a bunch for your church or whatever other context. Do that. Support people who are putting in hundreds of thousands of hours. I mean, the amount of hours that people put into producing a book, not just to write it, but to prepare for it. I mean, you've got to think some of these things are 10, 15, 20 years in the making. And so what they're actually making on these books is like less than a penny per hour or whatever it is. So like, support people, buy their books, you know, give up a coffee or go get free buy Folgers or something terrible. No, I'm kidding. I know we've got a lot of really coffee nerd people who listen.
And yeah, I'm with them.
That's some sort of heresy. But do something to support people like Simon and purchase their books, especially support people who aren't publishing with Oxford, so they're not making you pay $200 per volume. Yes. I mean, that in itself is worthy. Anyway, I'm droning on now, so I'll let you guys go. Thanks for everybody who's tuning in to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet, and we'll talk to you all soon.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.